Our first subject tonight is the aftermath of divorce. There are great dangers here of which we need to be warned. 30 years ago in 1980, when it became obvious that Mount St. Helens, which was a volcano in the state of Washington, was about to erupt, there was a man who lived on that mountain. His name was Harry Truman. He was warned that the mountain was going to explode, but he chose to stay there in his home anyway. When the volcano erupted, Harry Truman was blotted out in his physical life in a moment of time. He may never have even known what hit him, but he stayed on the mountain he loved and he died there, and there are worse ways to go. The blast of Mount St. Helens was an event. Divorce is not so much an event as it is a process. Whether you initiate that process or are subjected to it, you are going to hurt. I meet very few divorced people who are ever completely free of the pain of going through a divorce. There are scars that time never seems to erase. It's a process that in some ways never seems to end. The aftershocks of a divorce introduce a new chain of events that go on and on. Many have told me that if they had known how painful it would be, they would have stayed with the process of working at their marriage and trying to solve the problems there. When it comes to looking into the Pandora's box of divorce, what comes out of that box will haunt you in some way for the rest of your life, affecting your life in ways that you might never have imagined. That's especially true if you have children. 2/3 of people who divorce have children. If you choose to divorce, you will forever alter the course of your children's lives. If you have children when you divorce, you will damage those children. Children of divorce are much more likely to commit suicide than other children. Adolescent suicide rates have risen in correlation with divorce rates. They're much more likely as children of divorce to become homosexual because to best establish their sexual identity, they need both parents. Children of divorce are much more likely to become sexually promiscuous, much more likely to spend time in jail, more likely to become behavioral problems at school. Children of divorce are absent from school at much higher rates than other children, and they get lower grades than other children. The report cards of the children of divorce act as an emotional barometer of those children. They will tend to be insecure. They may develop an inordinate fear of being left alone. Some of them don't sleep well unless they can share a room with somebody else. Many of them begin to look like zombies, completely unable to concentrate. They tend to lose the ability to believe that a good marriage is even possible for them. They tend to lose the ability to trust one or both of their parents. More and more, they tend to take their cues not from their parents or their parents' generation, but from their own peers. And as they lean more heavily on their peers for their values, this often involves the use of drugs. Children of divorce have more illness, both mental and physical. They are usually subjected to the ongoing tug of war of their parents, fighting for their time and for their emotional support. They will usually be compelled to take sides in the fight between their parents, even when that's the last thing in the world that they want to do. Children of any age will be adversely affected by divorce. Their loyalties are torn between the two people in this world that they love the most. Children have a dream that I believe they're entitled to. It's a dream we might call happily ever after, and divorce robs children of that dream. It has everything to do with how they view their entire future. Divorce will leave your child with the inner feeling that his world is uncertain and unpredictable. Because the parents are feeling such traumatic and dramatic pain themselves, the children are often left wondering whether anybody loves them. They perceive that somehow the divorce was their fault, because they so often superstitiously believe that good things happen to you if you're good and bad things happen to you if you're bad. And so when their parents divorce, they're subject to thinking that they themselves somehow caused it or contributed to the cause, and they feel worthless and helpless and maybe as if they're being punished. Remember in The Sound of Music, when Baron von Tromp proposed to Maria, Maria saying, "I must have had a wicked childhood, I must have had a miserable youth, but somewhere in my wicked, miserable past, I must have done something good." That's based on that same idea. Children of divorce have a much greater risk that they themselves will fail at marriage when it comes their turn. I don't know what turn of events it was that took place that made people think that their happiness was more important than the happiness of their own children. Gerald Clevenger, who's a school counselor down in the area where I live and who many of you know, said that he wishes he could record the things that the kids in his office say on this subject and play them back to people who are considering divorce. But children are only one part of life that are affected by divorce if you are subjected to it or if you instigate it. If you divorce, your finances will be affected and maybe for years to come. And there's never enough money to go around. I have known a number of people who have lived in their cars following divorce. No frills is the rule after a divorce. Bankruptcy is very common. Often you spend multiplied thousands of dollars fighting each other, and the lawyers are the only real financial winners in the whole thing. Speaking of legal issues that are involved here, you find that the major decisions of your life when you get involved in a divorce are put into the hands of a judge who may or may not be fair. Likely he or she is either jaded or bitter or sick and tired or just burnt out from dealing with people who cut each other to pieces with words in their courtroom all day. And they may not even be really listening to anybody anymore. Judges are hard pressed for time, and your case is not likely to be given the time that's needed to make the most prudent of decisions. Judges can be extremely arbitrary in their rulings in divorce cases. Never is blind justice quite so blind as in some of these divorce cases. Don't count on justice in divorce court. Divorce lawyers in some circles are known as the armpit of the profession. One man told me that the divorce lawyer is to the legal profession what a proctologist is to the medical profession. However that may be, as in most professions, there are more bad ones than there are good ones. And you will be paying these people by the hour, so it's in their best financial interest to prolong the proceedings and make it go on and on as long as it can. And it only takes one angry person to run up the bill to punish the other person. What about remarriage? 95% of people who divorce remarry within 5 years. If you divorce with the idea that you'll do better next time, be aware that second marriages after a divorce have a less than 30% chance of surviving 5 years, and a third marriage after two divorces has less than a 15% chance of survival, statistically speaking. One of the leading causes of failure in a remarriage is the effect of the children. Children tend to remain loyal to their birth parents and to cause trouble for step-parents. Remarriage makes it more difficult for the children to get their birth parents back together, which is what many children are trying to do through the years. And often they continue to try after one or both parents are married to somebody else. And that often involves attempting to divide a parent from a step-parent. Children of remarriage will hurt you and color the atmosphere of your home. You can expect to hear, "You're not my father, you're not my mother," from angry children. A father who sees his children only once every 2 weeks finds it very difficult to say no, and so his children tend to get their way with him to their own detriment. In a remarriage, the parents are usually more closely bonded to their children than they are even to their new mate. They're apt to side with their children, which often causes all manner of grief for the new mate. And the new mate feels like an outsider. As one of them put it to me, he said, "I feel like I'm not even there." It's very common in a remarriage after divorce to have a yours, mine, ours mixture of offspring, and people very seldom feel about somebody else's children the same way they feel about their own. What about your extended circle of relationships? Divorcing your mate often means divorcing your friends as well. Relationships with scores of people will be affected. The way you relate to your closest friends may very likely never be quite the same. Married couples that you were close with before the divorce may avoid you rather than take sides. Mark Twain said, "It takes two people to hurt you, someone to say something bad about you, and your best friend to tell you what it was that they said." You will be hearing the bad things that are said about you from several different sources. You will hear these things from well-meaning friends whom you were hoping not to involve in your personal problems. You'll be hearing the bad things about yourself from people that you don't even care for and about whom you feel that this is really none of their business. There is hardly a personal question that will be left unasked of you. Your lawyer will ask you to reveal all your financial dealings for the last few years. And if you've ever done anything that looks even a little bit shady, your mate is likely to make sure that that comes to light. If a custody battle occurs, get ready for World War III. You and your mate will be probed by psychologists. A lengthy report will be written up and filed. That report can and will be used against you in court. People whom you considered for years to be your friends will write letters that will characterize you in a very bad light. Many people will say anything true or false to help a relative or a friend. You can be accused of things that contain not even a hint or a germ of truth, but you'll be accused of them just the same. You will hear the bad things that are said about you, and often you will hear about them from your own children. In fact, children are the favorite weapon of choice in a divorce battle. They are the surest way to get to your former spouse and for your former spouse to get to you. Obviously, children should never be used in this way, but they usually are used in this way. They will be debriefed after every visit to your house in search for information that will be useful in the battle. You may divorce with the hope that that other person, your ex, is now going to be out of your life. But you will probably see him or her a lot more than you ever thought you would, and at many times that you especially hoped that you would not see them. If you have children, you'll absolutely be forced to talk to one another. You'll see them at your children's school activities. You will talk to them when you arrange your child's visitation and to deal with the discipline of the children and the finances of the children. If an emergency occurs during your time of care for the children, you most likely will be dealing with accusations about your irresponsibility and your ineptness in taking care of your children. And you may expect vengeful behavior. You may even expect further legal action. You may be inquiring as to why support payments are late or non-existent. And your ex's name is going to keep on coming up over and over again. Some of your friends will inadvertently call your new mate by your old mate's first name. And you will need your old mate's signature from time to time on some piece of unfinished business or other. Your old mate may tend to enjoy provoking you or punishing you. Divorce wrecks holidays. Holidays will never be the same again, and it never ends. Divorce may impede your ability to deal with your relationships and your functions in the family of God, in the church, and that can happen on all kinds of levels and for all kinds of reasons. It's very easy for divorced people to feel like they're second-class citizens in the kingdom of heaven. And what about your own conscience and your own relationship to God? If you decide to divorce, you will have to deal with that conscience that we heard about in the last session. How will you feel about yourself if you leave your mate? Can you know with assurance that your future will be better than it is now? How does God view your decision to divorce your mate? You will have to answer to God on this issue. And God said that He hates divorce in the book of Malachi. He hates to see broken promises and He hates to see broken children. Fixing your marriage may be easier than breaking it. Even though today you may find that difficult to believe, in the long-term spectrum of life, that very well may be true. Take heart that there is hope. Take heart that there is help. If you're having marital problems, work on fixing them rather than destroying your relationship. Please count the cost of divorce. It doesn't earn when you sign the documents. Consider how your decision will affect other people. Your extended family is going to be affected forever. What about relationships and difficulties within yourself, your own relationship with yourself? Many of us, instead of learning from our mistakes, often just reinforce our mistakes. That's why we sometimes say, as we get older, there's no fool like an old fool. Sullen young men become grouchy older men. If you were not thoughtful or affectionate in your first marriage, what makes you think that you'll be any more affectionate in your second? We want to believe that we'll change, but the truth is we very rarely do much changing. And so we bring our weaknesses right along with us like unwanted baggage, and we find ourselves replicating the same problems in the second that we had in the first marriage because they are a part of who we are, and we changed everything except ourselves. We tend to fall in love with the same kind of person we just divorced. I've seen this over and over and over again. And if you despised a particular trait the first time around, how do you think you're going to react to it the second time around? There will be a tendency to compare your first and second situations, and if you start to see very many similarities, you may not only become very uncomfortable in the second situation, you may even feel a sense of panic. I've had people come to me with an actual sense of panic, that now I've done it again, I'm in the same situation I was in before, and you may overreact to behavior that reminds you of your first spouse. Divorce means rejection by the one person in the world who knows you best. And when the one person in the world who knows me best gives me a sense of rejection, then it's normal for me to think, well, when somebody gets to know the real me, I'm going to be rejected again. And so there's a sense of insecurity there, and there's a circle that goes around and around. After divorce, it's very common to experience a loneliness that is so severe that it's like nothing we've ever experienced in life, and it cuts like an Arctic wind. Many times people find that the vacuum of loneliness is harder to endure than the difficulties of the marriage ever were. And many become willing to alter their value system. Many become willing to alter their very religious convictions that they dug out of the Bible by themselves many years before and have believed for many years. I've seen people alter their very religious convictions if they think that that change of belief or their change of behavior is going to bring them some relief from their loneliness. Many sit in bars in semi-darkness late at night with hollow laughter and shallow conversation around them, hoping somehow to connect with someone who's going to care whether they live or die. Many turn to alcohol and other drugs to dull their pain. And lots of people go to the doctor hoping the doctor will write a prescription to help them handle their loneliness. One futile day chases the next day until life begins to pass without color and without meaning. Scripturally speaking, there are cases where divorce is allowable, but there are fewer cases where divorce is advisable. And my rule of thumb is, if in doubt, don't. If there is a shred of doubt that it's right, I don't see what you lose by waiting. Time doesn't make anything right or wrong, but it ensures that more sides of the question can be examined. Do you realize that if your thoughts about God, what God is, what He's like, are based on your own perceptions and your own feelings, then you're ultimately going to make God feel as you do in your own mind. If your thoughts about God and His beliefs are based on your own feelings about your life, you can always make God come around to see it your way because you will have created your own God in your own image. Remember, you and I will not be excused from a sin because we had poor counsel. Eve wasn't. Eve got some very bad advice, and she acted on it. She was not excused because of that. You and I must each stand or fall on the basis and on the merits of our own decisions that we make with our eyes wide open. We need to make our choices with extreme care. And remember that when God has expressed Himself on a subject, we needn't persist in having a different opinion. There's nothing as satisfying as a good marriage, and there's nothing quite as devastating as a bad one. Anything that has extraordinary potential for happiness has equal potential for disaster. Fact of the matter is, as I quoted before, God hates divorce. Malachi chapter 2, verse 16. In Malachi's day, the people were treating God like food. Food that they sniffed at to see whether they wanted to eat it or not. God was not on speaking terms with His people for 400 years because of the way they were behaving. And one of the most ungodly problems they had was a high rate of divorce. Even the priests were leaving the wives of their youth. And Malachi promised that one of the purposes of the coming new age would be to turn the hearts of the fathers back to the children and the hearts of the children to the fathers. The fathers must not have been very caring of their children if they were destroying their children's families. The foreign wives were raising the children to worship false gods. The children hating their fathers was a natural consequence of the fathers breaking up their homes. And this was one of the first issues that the new Elijah, John the Baptist, was going to address. He was beheaded for speaking out on this very issue about Herod's immoral marriage to his brother's wife. "It is not lawful for thee to have her," he said. God considered this issue so important that he allowed one of his favorite men to be put to death, sacrificed for it. And Jesus himself said in Matthew 19:9, "Whosoever putteth away his wife except for fornication and shall marry another committeth adultery, and whoso marrieth her which is put away doth commit adultery." If you go into a new marriage as an adulterer, don't be surprised if your new mate always wonders if you'll be faithful to them, because they already know that you are an adulterer. It's never worth it to cross God. Divorce is one of a very select number of things that God hates. In my understanding of the Bible, I've only come across, I believe, 11 things that the Bible specifically says that God hates. And most of those 11 are somehow involved in most divorces. Back from the book of Proverbs, we see that one of the things that God hates is a proud look, haughty eyes, eyes that look down on other people. "My happiness is more important than your happiness or the children's happiness or anybody else's happiness." Surely a proud look is often involved when we come to the subject of divorce. The second thing is a lying tongue. You made promises before God and human witnesses. You contracted for better or for worse till death do us part. Pardon me then for calling people liars when they divorce because we just grew apart. Or when they divorce because he stifled my intellectual growth. Or when they divorced because she didn't meet my needs, or I lost respect for him, or he was too moody, or all we ever did was argue. I'm not sure I ever really loved him in the first place, or I was just too young to know what I wanted. I've heard all these used as excuses for divorce. Are these problems significant? Absolutely. Are these problems fixable? Absolutely. All these problems, and many more, have been solved to everybody's satisfaction many, many times. What happened to the vow that you took? What happened to that vow? Did it get old just because it happened a while back? That vow is as binding now as it was on the day that you took it. Thou shalt not lie used to be taken a lot more seriously than it is these days. 50 years ago, when I was a boy growing up here in the Middle West, I heard that the measure of a man is his word, and a man's word is his bond. And a man's word is really all he's got. And if you can keep your word, you can keep your friends. And that you ought not to make promises that you can't keep. Those were common statements 50 years ago, when a handshake was as good as a signed contract. When I see somebody standing by their mate through thick and thin, they earn my respect. Proud look, a lying tongue. Hands that shed innocent blood, God hates them also. In divorce, you may not shed it literally, but every divorce devastates innocent bystanders. I'll never forget my wife and I one time telling our daughter that a certain couple that she was close to, the children in that family, that they were getting a divorce, and my daughter cried. And I'll never forget how awful I felt. That actually happened on more than one occasion. You may not literally shed innocent blood, but you cause innocent tears to be shed. Every divorce devastates innocent bystanders, family, friends. Your parents will be damaged if they're still living. New arrangements are going to be an awful lot more awkward. A heart that deviseth wicked imaginations, that's another thing that God hates. All divorces are premeditated by at least one of the parties. I never saw a divorce happen accidentally when both parties were saying, what happened? We didn't know we were getting a divorce. It has to be premeditated by somebody. How many problems could be solved if people would put their minds to solving their marital difficulties instead of just finding a quick way out of them? God loves it when people premeditate good, and we're each capable of doing that. Feet that be swift in running to mischief, that's another thing that God hates. And an awful lot of the time in these divorce situations, there is a third party lurking somewhere in the shadows of that divorce. And people will tell me up and down, there's nobody else, when I highly suspect that there is. And sure enough, it often turns out that there was and is. A neglected mate is a prime candidate for adultery. And the maid who did the neglecting should be willing to extend grace when this has been the case. A false witness that speaketh lies, that's another thing that the Lord says that He hates. How many people have been asked to lie on behalf of one of the divorcing partners to give them an advantage in the legal process, usually concerning child custody? People have been asked flatly to lie in order to allow the child custody case to turn out the way that somebody wants it to turn out. It's a common practice to accuse a mate of having a drug or alcohol problem to create doubt as to their fitness as a parent. There is hardly a lie that has not been told during the process of divorce. The seventh thing that God hates is he that soweth discord among brethren. Divorce tends to force friends to take sides. It does sow discord among brethren. It always spreads strife all across this country. I haven't kept track of it. I have not kept account of it, but I guess I'm glad I didn't. But for the last 40 years, I have been seeing from place to place across this country congregations split apart over the ramifications of a divorce within the group. And the sowing of that discord among brethren goes back, at least in part, to that divorcing couple. In Jeremiah 44, verses 4 and 5, we find that God hates it when we burn incense to other gods. When people divorce, somebody has a god besides the one true and living God. There's no divorce where somebody was not guilty of that. In Amos chapter 5, verse 21, God said, "I hate your feast days because of your hypocrisy." Often in divorce, if not always, hypocrisy is involved. "Esau have I hated," the Lord said. Esau didn't think the things of God were important. When there's a divorce happening, somebody didn't think the things of God were very important. Jesus said that he hated the deeds and the doctrine of the Nicolaitans in the book of Revelation, which had to do with immoral practices as well. There are consequences for people who initiate divorce. The feeling that as a Christian you took a wrong turn and missed God's best. Guilt over the damage that you have done. The reality that you may have been more of a problem in your marriage than you care to admit. If your situation involved infidelity, wondering whether your new mate is going to be faithful. It'll be a long time before people will take you as seriously as they perhaps did before. Because trust is the basis of any relationship. And when you violate trust, its loss can be a bitter pill. Your children's feelings about you will tend to never be the same. Now, as we're sitting here today with a group this size, it's obviously true there may be a marriage or marriages here that are in trouble. If that's true in your case, you need to acknowledge that, at least to yourself, and as you and your spouse, you need to acknowledge that that is true. But I have learned this. Solving people's marriage problems has a lot more to do with the character of the people involved than it does with the complexity of the problems involved. If the character of the people is what it ought to be, they can fix virtually anything with the help of our Heavenly Father. If you believe in marriage like God believes in marriage, then make it work. Go to whatever lengths you personally need to go to make it work. And if both you and your spouse will do that, then you will make it work. Give each other a new slate on which to write a new story of your marriage. It may be that as you're sitting here right now, you have biblical, scriptural grounds for divorce. But according to everything I've seen, it would still be in your best interest to consider a reconciliation. Even if it didn't work, you would still have the knowledge that you did everything possible to maintain that relationship. After all, Rome wasn't built in a day. It takes time to get into what has become a troubled marriage, and it takes time to fix it. So you ought to measure your progress by the month, not by the day. If you measure it by the day, you'll too easily get discouraged. Measure it by the month, remembering that you are human too. Old bad habits are hard to break. So give your mate the freedom to fail just as you would like to have. Give yourself time to rebuild trust. There will be doubts, and you're going to have to fight them, or they will wear you down and rob you of any incentive and motivation that you have to keep going. Pray for the strength to do your part in rebuilding your marriage, and pray for your mate. But please keep your mind primarily on your own efforts, not on the efforts of your mate. Because remember this, your mate absolutely cannot try as hard as you want them to try. You want them to fix it right now. You want them to change completely, and maybe they want the same about you. Neither one of you is going to do that. That's just real human life. But real incremental human change can take place, and it must take place. And we each need to keep the focus on ourselves. I need to be the best husband that I can. My wife needs to be the best wife that she can. If we keep that focus there, then with God's help, we can fix it. I don't care what the problem has been. We can fix it. The major problem that you face in reconciliation, no matter what the marital problems have been, the major problem you face in reconciliation is your attitude. If you believe that your problems are unresolvable, then almost by definition they will be. The single most important decision I can make on a day-to-day basis is my choice of my own attitude. My own attitude is more important than my past. It's more important than education or bankroll or successes or failures or what other people think about me or say about me. My attitude is more important than any of that. I am a firm believer that life is 10% what happens to you and 90% how you respond to it. I can tell you this. If you won't forgive, then you won't reconcile. And sometimes the hardest person to forgive is your mate. Because your mate is the one who best knows how to deeply hurt you. They know what makes you tick, and they know what buttons to push. And so hurt progresses to anger, and anger progresses to hatred, and you end up hating one another. The Bible addresses that. The Bible tells us that hatred consumes us, colors our life gray and then black. We find darkness everywhere we look because we carry that darkness within us. And if your eye is darkness, then how deep is that darkness? But forgiveness is the key that opens up the possibility of reconciliation. We are told that if we expect God to forgive us, then we must forgive one another. And nowhere is forgiveness more important than in the area of marriage. We forgive by saying, "You don't owe me. I'm pushing the restart button. You've got a new slate here. You don't owe me for anything of the past. We're starting over because I say we're starting over, and I'm the one who has the right to forgive you." Just as God does for us. It makes it easier for me to forgive when I remember that God has forgiven me. I can't have it both ways. I can't demand grace for myself and demand justice for everybody else. If I'm going to accept God's grace for myself, then I have to allow grace to other people, starting with my mate. So grace gives a new place for you to start, and grace gives a new place for your marriage to start and for your spouse to start. And when we extend to one another forgiveness and grace, then we can do what Paul enjoined upon all of us in Romans 15, verse 7. Receive one another as Christ also received us to the glory of God.